Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. You've done it, Craig. Many people didn't think it was possible. You found Florida's worst idea.
Well, for this year, at least. What I was proposing in my column this week for the Florida Phoenix is that we have an annual laughably bad idea contest, and that, you know, some years it'll be a real stiff competition because, hey, it's Florida. But other years we'll have a very clear winner. I mentioned that in 2011 there was an idea to let Jack Nicklaus build golf courses in the state parks, which is people heaped ridicule on that idea for a week until
rightly so. Yeah,
this is in that vein. It's not as bad as that, but the idea is the people who run the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge, which is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they have put forward this plan to open up the refuge, quote unquote, to thousands of people and let them come in and hunt turkeys and drive around on off-road vehicles and fly drones and conduct commercial guided tours through the place and go fishing and basically invade this 26,000 acres that was specifically set aside to give the panthers some respite from humans, because humans have been chasing them out of just about everywhere else. And what really kind of pushes it over the top is that the refuge has a staff of two people.
Yeah.
So there'd be two people overseeing all these thousands of folks coming in and, you know, littering and getting lost on the trails and getting bitten by alligators and stealing orchids and, you know, all this kind of thing, occasionally shooting the wrong thing because people do that. And so I've suggested that this would be the pretty clear winner of that contest.
Well, when it comes to doing something that almost no one is asking for at the great peril of an endangered species that happens to be the state animal that we don't have the money for, it hits a lot of the checks, a lot of the boxes for when it comes to worst ideas.
Oh yeah. I give them a standing ovation.
Where is this coming from?
Hunters have been wanting to get into the refuge for 10 years, to shoot the deer in there for one thing. Well, that's probably not going to happen, at least not right now, because the panthers eat the deer. But there are lots of turkey flocks out there. And so they were saying, we'd love to come in and hunt the turkeys. And the irony here, which I highlighted in the column, is that their argument for getting into the refuge to hunt is that they've been pushed out of other places they used to hunt by all the development, development that has taken away the panther land. So the panthers need the refuge. So now they're saying, well, we need a refuge too to go hunting. Which is, you know, I sort of gently mocked that idea, let's just say.
So is this, how likely is this to happen?
Well, it's gotten all the way to the point where they had a public hearing on it in May, and they're taking comments on it, and then they're supposed to make a decision about it, by August or September of this year.
Wow, that's quick. Now, let me play politics here a little bit. I thought these cockamamie ideas were going to go by the wayside when Trump left office. Why is this a federal piece of land. You're talking about the U.S. correct. Fish and Wildlife Service, a national wildlife refuge. This is not a state deal. This is a federal thing. Biden administration go ahead. Yep.
This actually started under the Obama administration. There was an initiative in the Obama administration to open up public lands to people, to let more people get in and have access to these public lands, so that people would have a greater appreciation for what the federal government owns, these beautiful landscapes and so forth, which is, that's fine. But I argue that the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge is a special case, because panthers are very solitary. They don't like to be around humans. This was set up specifically to give them a home. And if you let lots of people in there, it will not be.
And I think that's why there is a national park, and a national wildlife refuge is a very different thing from a national park. Yosemite, Yellowstone, Glacier, those are national parks, and they've got a lot of wildlife and they've got, you know, great habitat and landscapes, but they are managed for these huge crowds of tourists.
Yeah.
National wildlife refuges are something very different. And what that very difference is right there in the name. Yeah. Refuge.
Well, refuge. Well,
for animals.
The very first, I didn't mention this in the column, but the very first national wildlife refuge it was ever created was created here in Florida.
Right.
Pelican Island National Wildlife Refuge, created in 1905 by President Teddy Roosevelt, because hunters were going onto the island and killing all the pelicans for their feathers, because that was the fashion for ladies' hats back then. And so he declared there would be no hunting allowed, no people allowed. It was strictly for pelicans. And that the idea caught on. It spread across the country. Other countries have now copied our National Wildlife Refuge system. So, like I said, this is one of those things where there's a sort of a cookie cutter template that's being applied to federal property all around the country. And it, if you apply it to this particular piece of property, it just doesn't work. It doesn't fit what's going on there.
Agree 100%. You can read all about that in the Florida Phoenix online, floridaphoenix.com. Our guest this week, Carlton Ward Jr., carltonward.com. He is a driving force behind the Florida Wildlife Corridor, floridawild.com, floridawildlifecorridor.org. You can follow Carlton online at Carlton Ward on both Twitter and Instagram for social media. Recently, big news here with the Florida Wildlife Corridor and the passage of the Florida Wildlife Corridor Act late in June 2021. Real briefly, Craig, tell us a little bit about Carlton and his involvement with this movement.
Well, Carlton is a native Floridian. His, I think it was his great-grandfather was actually governor of Florida. Through his art, through his photography, has shown people a lot of the beauty in the Florida landscape. But beyond just showing them, he has been very active in trying to persuade people of the need to protect this land, and particularly to protect the pieces of property, the private property, that links our public property, links state parks to national wildlife refuges, like the one I mentioned, to national parks, state forests, et cetera, so that those don't just become islands of wildlife, but that, in fact, there's a way to connect them all. And he's got an interesting role in this, and he's got skin in the game. He's put himself on the line to actually go out and show people this property himself through the Florida Wildlife Corridor expedition.
Florida Wildlife Corridor is an idea that has captivated me even before I got to Florida. So this is an episode I've been looking forward to since we kicked off the podcast over a year ago now. So let's get to it. Carlton Ward Jr.
Carlton, before we get into the whole Florida Wildlife Corridor thing, let me ask you, how did you become a nature photographer, a landscape photographer in Florida?
Well, that could be a 45-minute answer. So let me. I went off to college. I didn't set out to become a photographer. I was kind of finding my way, but I ended up studying biology. I studied anthropology. I got really interested in conservation issues and kind of more aware of the trajectory of humanity on this planet if we didn't make some changes. And about the same time, I got a camera on the side and really enjoyed the craft of taking pictures. But it was actually away from Florida where I got into photography. And then after I graduated, all the landscapes I had grown up with were photo opportunities for the first time. And so there's really like this passion and enthusiasm for the home landscapes that had shaped my vision all along, but I just hadn't had the tools to capture and share them before that.
Did you grow up camping and canoeing and so forth here in Florida?
I did. Yeah, I was thankful to have grown up close to the coast in Clearwater. So a lot of early years at Clearwater Marine Science Center, summer camps, wading and snorkeling on the grass flats, and later surfing and fishing offshore, and Boy Scouts and camping, and cousins who are full-time cattle ranchers, and some ranch land in the family. So a little bit of time on horseback in the heartland as well.
Before we leave photography, we had Clive Butcher on a previous episode, and I'm going to ask you the question I did him for all of the Sunday photographers, the weekend photographers, the folks out there who are going through their ISO settings and all that sort of stuff, trying to make good pictures. What's one simple piece of advice you would give for amateur photographers about shooting landscapes or wildlife in Florida?
Find something that you're passionate about and then give yourself the time that it's going to take to succeed, because really memorable pictures don't happen quickly, except a rare once in a while. It's going back to a place over and over, seeing it in different light, waiting for that magical composition of elements that makes a picture that is more than a snapshot.
Now, your first photo project, I guess, was your Florida Cowboys book. That was your first passion, was showing them working in the Florida landscape, sort of in a landscape that goes back to the 1800s.
Yes, that is my first Florida photo project. I got a little distracted with Africa.
I can see where that could happen.
During after undergraduate, I did an internship at the Smithsonian Institution, and I got connected to some really cool researchers who were doing different things all over the world. And I got to go be the photographer for a biodiversity inventory in equatorial West Africa in the country of Gabon. And I went there and went on 6 different expeditions over the course of 3 years. And that's where I really kind of formed the philosophy for my work today, where I was using photography combined with science as an outreach and advocacy tool. It just so happened that every time I got on an airplane and left Florida for a couple months, I came home and there was a new subdivision on what used to be a cattle ranch. And so across those 3 years of doing really once in a lifetime type of work in Gabon, I was called home because I felt like, what am I doing exporting this conservation ethic to a developing African country where we're losing 100,000 acres or more every year in Florida and people aren't talking about it. So that's what led me to the ranch story. It was, this was back in 2004, 2005, pretty close to the beginning of the comprehensive Everglades restoration plan. So my thought process and my 20-something-year-old mind was, you know, should I focus on the Everglades for a long-term project, or maybe I'll focus on ranches because it's an even lesser-known story with great consequences. And that's what led me into that project. Turns out, I learned a few years later that by photographing ranches, I was photographing the Everglades all along because the way the headwaters and this whole landscape fits together. But yes, you're right. My first major work in Florida was a book called Florida Cowboys, Keepers of the Last Frontier, because, and still many people don't know that there's 5 million acres of cattle ranch in Florida, and this is the connective tissue for much of our state's wildlife habitat.
Yeah. Did that help to lay the groundwork for the Florida Wildlife Corridor idea that you had?
Absolutely. Yeah, being out on ranches opened my eyes to so many things about Florida. I learned about conservation easements. I met people like Kerry Lightsey, who had protected 90% of their land through conservation easements. I met a bear biologist named Joe Guthrie, who was putting GPS collars on Florida black bears in Highlands County. And those bears happened to be living primarily on cattle ranches. And the story of those bears and how they relied upon a patchwork of land, and in this case, primarily private land, but it's the network of connected habitats, National Wildlife Refuge, your state park, your state forest, your cattle ranch, your citrus grove, all together form this green fabric. And you could look at a satellite image or fly over in an airplane and you can imagine how the green land connects. But when a bear wearing a GPS collar gives you a trail that shows exactly where he or she walks over the course of a year, it really illustrates that this concept of wildlife corridors is alive and real.
How did you meet Joe? Because you guys are like the sort of the originators of the corridor expedition.
It was in 2006. I was at Archibald Biological Station. I was there to photograph Buck Island Ranch, which is one of the ranches that was going to be in our annual Florida Ranches calendar. I was building towards the Florida Cowboys book and photographing the ranches. And Hillary Swain, the station's executive director, introduced me to Joe. I went out with him where he was catching a black bear on the Hendry Ranch. And, you know, the rest of that is history.
We did a previous episode on Buck Island Ranch and ranching and conservation and the connection there. You can go ahead and find that in the archives on the episode titled Ranching in Florida. So as we transition to talking about wildlife corridors and the Florida Wildlife Corridor, what is a wildlife corridor and why are they so important?
A wildlife corridor is a connected network of land that provides contiguous habitat for wildlife. The name corridor can be a little bit confusing because it often refers to a hallway or a narrow connection. But we can contrast a wildlife corridor to a wildlife crossing. A wildlife crossing would be an underpass or an overpass that helps wildlife get across a road. The wildlife corridor is the big network of green infrastructure on either side of that road that wildlife depend on for their everyday survival.
And why are they so important as opposed to parks or the isolated areas of conservation?
Florida is a really good incubator for this kind of idea, because the peninsula is skinny. We have massive population growth. And just because we have 4 million acres of contiguous protected land in the Everglades doesn't mean that the wildlife or the ecosystem services there are secure, because without the connection to other protected areas, animals like the Florida panther don't have enough room to survive. And ecosystem services like the flow of water from the headwaters near Orlando will be interrupted. If you look at it, you take a virtual journey through the Florida Peninsula, you've got these big stepping stones of public conservation lands, the Everglades in the south, Ocala National Forest in the center, Apalachicola National Forest near Tallahassee, Osceola National Forest in the Okefenokee Swamp, the Green Swamp, Ocala Coochee Slough State Forest, huge investments in public land that if we go on our current trajectory, they will mostly become surrounded by development. And as you do that, you lose the function of those conservation lands. It's not just the wide-ranging wildlife like the bear and the panther that need more habitat than just the piece of public land that we name such, but it's also processes like prescribed fire and sheet flow of water, all these green infrastructure functions that the connected network provides too. Without wildlife corridors, I've been told that our public lands are zoos without bars. And that's not a future that any of us want.
This idea for a Florida wildlife corridor, take us back to, you know, the inception, the early stages, this vision that, you know what, with a little bit of this and a little bit of that, you take a state park here and a national park there and a ranch here and a forest there. And all of a sudden, hey, this is just crazy enough to work. How did that idea get going, and how did you tie into it?
My journey into this project really began with the cattle ranch and the Florida black bear. And so I'd been photographing ranches, and I started to understand the scope and scale of this conservation opportunity, and also how precarious the future of these ranches were. At the same time, I was introduced to the Florida black bear by Joe Guthrie and began to see the bear as an emblem for wildlife corridors. The more I learned about bears, the more of a symbol they became, because Florida used to have bears in every county. And really? Now we have bears in 7 semi-isolated subpopulations, all the way from the Panhandle near Pensacola to the Everglades near Naples, and most places in between. If we want a viable statewide bear population, the Florida Wildlife Corridor is the answer. The populations in big places like the Everglades, Ocala National Forest, Apalachicola, they're doing just fine. The bear populations in smaller places like Chazawitzka are becoming those zoos without bars. They're becoming fragmented and isolated to the point that these bears are completely inbred. Yeah. And their lifeline to survival is the Withlacoochee River, or that wildlife corridor that ties them back to the big core population. As I started to learn about the bears, I started to learn about the science. And there's a man named Tom Hochter from the University of Florida who is the architect of basically a green infrastructure plan for Florida called the Florida Ecological Greenways Network. And he's a student of the late Larry Harris from the University of Florida, who wrote the book, The Fragmented Forest, back in the 1980s, who advocated for one of the really early advocates of functional wildlife corridors. They connected the Okefenokee Swamp to the Osceola National Forest in North Florida by protecting a piece of the puzzle in between called the Pinhook Swamp. And that was an early test case. Tom Hochter is in that academic lineage of Larry Harris, as was David Mayer, who is the panther biologist, who was the graduate advisor for Joe Guthrie, who is doing the bear work. And so there's this like lineage back to the fragmented forest and Larry Harris at the University of Florida. And as a journalist and a storyteller, I kind of saw that underlying science, and then also realized how far removed this was from the public conversation. And that's where the Florida Wildlife Corridor idea came from. Tom Hochter was giving a presentation at a bear workshop at Archibald, and he presented the Florida Ecological Greenways Network, and he presented all these different regional corridors. There was a Caloosahatchee connector. There was an Ocala to Osceola Ecological Greenway option 1 and 2. There's the Ocala to Osceola corridor in the north. And my suggestion as a somewhat naive 27-year-old is like, wow, can we put all these together and call them Florida Wildlife Corridor so people will know what we're talking about? And I had no idea what I was getting myself into. This is 2009. Tom Hochter's like, let's talk about that. And we got together and commissioned a painting that would take that science and illustrate a vision for a connected landscape in Florida. We worked with the Nature Conservancy, Archibald Biological Station, Conservation Florida, Audubon Florida, Florida Wildlife Federation, Defenders of Wildlife, various ranchers, and started workshopping the idea, talking about it, saying, what do we name it? They all seemed like Florida Wildlife Corridor was a decent idea. And on Earth Day 2010, we came out with a watercolor painting that just kind of tried to put a name on this opportunity. Mm-hmm.
I think I remember seeing that because I've donated to the Nature Conservancy and Audubon for years, long before I moved to Florida, which would have been 2012 when I moved here. And that singular image, and this is the power of art or imagery. You could talk to your blue in the face. You could write a book. You could do a podcast. You could give 1,000 speeches to show the peninsular Florida and that ribbon of dark green connecting Florida Bay to, you know, the panhandle is so, to me anyways, and I'm sure tens of thousands of other people, was so immediately captivating, so bold, so grandiose, so audacious and all-encompassing of climate change and protecting the Everglades and protecting the panther and protecting bears and protecting birds and migratory habitat. I mean, it gave you the whole thing all at once. That was a truly powerful image that did obviously the job of captivating people, certainly far outside of that niche conservation community.
Okay, but so how do you go from saying, okay, here's a picture of what the corridor would look like, to saying, we're going to go travel the corridor and show you what it looks like from the ground up? Because that's really audacious and a little crazy.
Yeah, a little crazy. I look back at my 20-something self and kind of think that right now as well. But I have some role models at National Geographic. There was a guy named Mike Fay. He made our expedition look like a walk in the park. He traveled for 455 days for well over 1,000 miles from the center part of Congo to the Atlantic coast in Gabon. It was called the Mega Transect. It was a 3-part series in National Geographic magazine. A photography role model, Nick Nichols, did the imagery. But with the resulting story, they inspired the president of Gabon to create 13 new national parks based on the route and the awareness that expedition created. And that was just in the year 2000. So this was kind of like a modern day Ansel Adams, you know, imagery presented to lawmakers with a narrative that led to tangible conservation action. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the idea, like, wow, we need to raise awareness for this. How are we going to raise awareness? Well, we need to document it. Let's go on an expedition and kind of ground truth this idea that we still have a connected corridor from the Everglades to Georgia. So that's what we did in 2012. And it was Joe and myself and fellow conservationist Mallory Likes Demet, who is a multi-generation Floridian herself and had been working for the Nature Conservancy in Colorado on a multi-state land conservation program. So this was right up her alley. And we traveled for 100 days and 1,000 miles by kayak and by foot and a little bit of horseback and bicycling from Everglades National Park to the Okefenokee Swamp. By the time we got to the Okefenokee, we realized we'd only told half the story. And so, you know, a couple years later, we did an expedition of similar scale, starting at the Everglades headwaters near Orlando, the center point of the first expedition, and going around the Gulf Coast to Alabama. So through that process, that was kind of the, there was a fair amount of public awareness, I would say, that came from some of the films and media publications. There was also a lot of stakeholder, we were developing partnerships. Like, there's no better way than to test an idea than to ask permission from a rancher if you can come camp on their property to tell the story of how it's part of a statewide wildlife corridor. And on the 2012 expedition, we camped on more than 30 different cattle ranches as we traversed north through the state, and a similar number of timberlands in the subsequent expeditions. So all along the way, we're kind of following a geographic journey, but really developing this human journey and their relationships with these people who want to be part of the solution. They want these lands. They want the option or the alternative to not develop these lands. And so that really gave a strong foundation for trying to keep the cause going.
Yeah. You talk about ranching and timber, and that's an interesting relationship with the conservation movement, because typically those folks have been at odds. How have you seen the approach or the collaboration between ranching, timber, what are known as working lands when we talk about wildlife corridors, and the straight up, you know, conservation movement align finally or eventually towards this shared vision of non-development, at least?
It's been a real evolution. I mean, I've been doing calendars with the Florida Cattlemen's Association since 2006. And in the very beginning, you know, they only wanted me to show a person on a horse with a cow in every single picture. And over the past 15 years, there's been a real evolution and a recognition that, you know, these ranches are in fact imperiled. And the cattle ranchers who want to keep ranching for the future have more in common with the Florida panther or the Florida black bear than they might have previously acknowledged. Mm-hmm. And there's actually ways now where the Florida cowboy could be considered an endangered species, and the Florida panther might actually be able to help them save their land, because it will create more public incentive for conservation investment. You know, it's certainly not every rancher wants to do conservation. Not every rancher is open or excited about having panthers or bears on their land, but there is a core group of ranchers who are really committed to the future of their way of life and to the land that they love. And that's come to the foreground lately. And I think faster in Florida than other places. And it's because of that common ground, the fact that this land is vanishing so quickly and the future of these species and of the working lands are so interconnected.
When you were doing your expedition, what was the hardest part?
I'll answer in two ways. I mean, I think on one hand, the hardest thing on the expedition was sustaining the media production, because after you hike or paddle for 15 miles, the last thing you want to do is get out your laptop and write a short story for the Tampa Bay Times about what you experienced that week. But that was the whole point of our expedition, or a huge point was to help share the story. So that grind of doing the expedition and, you know, showing up every Saturday for a public hike and staying on schedule. I mean, that you think a 100-day expedition in the Florida woods would be this maybe choose your own adventure type of thing, but mm-hmm. it's the most regimented my life has ever been.
Really?
Because we had an Excel spreadsheet that had a GPS point of a campsite and then in the number of miles 100 days into the future. Because how else can you have Craig Pittman from the St. Pete Times mm-hmm. come join you and know where you're going to meet 3 weeks from now, or Attorney General Pam Bondi and Commissioner of Agriculture Adam Putnam paddled the St. John's River with us in March of 2012. And we had to tell them where we were going to meet them, you know, 6 weeks in advance. And so it was, this was not a Lewis and Clark affair. It was really,
we'll get there when we get there.
it was a forced march in a lot of ways. But there were some real, you know, physical challenges as well. And started early in the 2012 expedition, we had just estimated from satellite imagery where we might be able to find dry land to camp in the sawgrass of the Everglades. And we got to a certain tree island after 12 miles of push-pulling through the sawgrass, and there was no dry land anywhere. And so we push-pulled through the night, all night. Ooh. To the next proposed location, and there was barely any dry land there, but we were able to make do. Way up in the panhandle, there's a stretch of the Florida National Scenic Trail coming out of the west side of Apalachicola National Forest called Bradwell Bay, and it's about waist deep in water. It was about 36 degrees that day, and we were we were in for it. But those are the things you never forget, and I'm privileged to have had a chance to see.
Now, at what point did you start talking to legislators about making this become a reality?
Going back to the expeditions, we invited lawmakers to join us all the way through, but there were usually just a handful who would come out and hike with you or come out and see it. There is a time period in, I'm trying to put a pin on, but in the last 2 or 3 years where we realized it was time to really try to make a push for legislative recognition. It's always been part of the strategy for the Florida Wildlife Corridor campaign. There, the first part was going to be awareness and then recognition or designation and then continuing towards long-term protection. And for me personally, it was kind of a confluence of things. It was a big investment in built infrastructure, new toll roads coming, lots of investment in long-range planning for transportation. It was request for Florida Forever. They were still not big enough to solve the problem. And it was like a now or never moment. Like if we want to save some of these critical linkages, some of these last green threads that are holding the corridor together, we need to take the conversation to the highest level of decision in the state and really talk about it. And that's what led to the effort with the legislative push in over the past year.
Did the controversy over the M-Course toll roads actually wind up helping you guys, bring in, sort of giving it a higher profile that the need to save these corridors?
You know, I haven't fully thought through all this, but I will say that it got people thinking about the future. Mm-hmm. And there's a strong parallel between building roads and building green infrastructure. And if we're willing to spend billions of dollars in our built infrastructure, we need to be making a pretty big investment in the green infrastructure too, or they're not going to work together. And I think that the lawmakers and the public were maybe more receptive than or tuned in to green infrastructure than they might have been in the past because of the big conversation about the roads and the transportation infrastructure. So I do think in a way it helps set the stage to recognize that we need both.
Yeah. Fast forward to the end of June 2021 and the Florida Wildlife Corridor Act was signed into law, passed the legislature unanimously, which is, I won't say it's unprecedented, but it is certainly a rarity.
Yeah.
And signed into law by the governor. So what does the Florida Wildlife Corridor Act do?
At first, it names and defines this geography. There's that Florida Ecological Greenways Network that we talked about earlier. The Florida Wildlife Corridor, as now defined in Florida law, is the priority 1, 2, and 3 linkages in the Florida Ecological Greenways Network. It is an 18 million acre network of land. 10 million acres are already conserved lands. 8 million acres are what we call opportunity areas. Within those opportunity areas are last best chances to save the statewide corridor. It so happens that 2 million acres and 80% of the state's Florida Forever priorities are also in the Florida Wildlife Corridor. So there's a lot of synergy with existing land conservation programs. Beyond naming the geography, the legislation talks about the idea of increasing investment in land conservation, attracting new types of investment in land conservation, and sets the goal and the objective of saving this connected habitat.
It also puts no small amount of money towards it, correct?
Those were related, but the funding is not part of the Florida Wildlife Corridor Act. The
Gotcha.
Act is naming the geography, but through that process, state leadership, I can't say exactly what they're thinking, but it seems that this process, the identity of the corridor, inspired more investment in land conservation. I'm really thankful for that. There was $100 million going into Florida Forever. Senator Simpson had the idea to put another $300 million that we had available from federal stimulus this year on top of that to try to get more done. I feel hopeful that that type of investment can continue.
Yeah. How important is the act and the $400 million to seeing this dream become a reality?
This is a huge step forward, but it's really just the beginning of the next journey. If we think about the scale of conservation that's needed and the scale of the opportunity, it's going to take $400 million from the state every year or more for the next decade, and it's going to take equal or more money from the federal government plus other private incentives to work together to achieve this opportunity. But being able to define the identity and see the enthusiasm and the engagement for it was really rewarding and really motivating. It gives me a lot of hope that this is truly a common ground solution that everybody can get behind.
Yeah. And that sounds like a lot of money, and it is a lot of money, but don't let anyone tell you it's not there. It is. If this is a priority to the state and the federal government and the legislature, the money's there, despite how much it is. It's there.
Now, what's the connection between your work on the Florida Wildlife Corridor expeditions and your most recent project, Path of the Panther, that just recently ran in National Geographic? With gorgeous pictures, I might add.
Thank you. The Path of the Panther project for me was, and for our team was an effort to try to bring the Florida Wildlife Corridor idea to wider audiences. We've done a great job with building a baseline awareness for the corridor with stakeholders and here in the state of Florida. But the Florida Panther, our state animal, which is the last puma east of the Mississippi River, an icon of the Everglades, and perfect ambassador for the corridor, it helped open up the conversation and get more excitement about why we need to save the Florida Wildlife Corridor. So from the very beginning, the Path of the Panther project, its purpose is to inspire appreciation and protection of the corridor. And it just so happened that 1.5 years into the Path of the Panther project, the first female panther in my lifetime was documented north of the Coosawhatchie River. And so this was the Florida Wildlife Corridor in action. Mm-hmm. We had Babcock Ranch State Preserve, which could have been a development, but was in large part protected, being the home for the first female panther north of the Coosawhatchie River since 1973. And the first kittens documented born in that territory in that time. So all of a sudden we have this emblem of hope, and we have this moment where all the conservation from the past 50 years is building to a tipping point. And the Florida Panther is showing us what we need to do to save this corridor, not just for panthers, but for quality of life for all Floridians. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really great illustration. And I was so thankful to have the investment of National Geographic Society in this work, and to be able to have copies of that National Geographic magazine to hand out to every state lawmaker at the same time the Florida Wildlife Corridor legislation is being considered. I think the panther really helped us.
Yeah. That first female panther north of the Coosawhatchie is such an important moment, because it does show that there is an opportunity to not just hang on to this population by your fingernails and hope that, another animal doesn't get hit by a car. It allows for the possibility anyhow that this population could actually expand, could go into, territory it hasn't been seen in, like you said, in almost 50 years, that population could then expand, and then the gene pool can expand, and then it becomes a healthier population. And all of a sudden it's going back to the O-to-O corridor, the Osceola to the Ocala. And then maybe one day when we're all long gone, there's panther in the Okefenokee swamp again. And that's these linkages and why they're so important, and why this is such a bold, visionary idea. But those are panthers, and we've talked about bears. So how does this benefit people? What if I'm in a high rise in Boca and I say, well, why do I care about panthers? I moved here to retire 5 years ago. Why is this a big deal to me or something I should care about?
That is a very good question. And there are a lot of answers to that. But what the panthers and the bears are doing, and they're showing us what we need to do for ourselves. And if you look at the Florida Wildlife Corridor through the Florida Peninsula, that's the headwaters in almost the entirety of the Everglades watershed. And it's the St. John's watershed. And the lands that are the missing links that we need for the panther are the sources of drinking water for well over half the Florida population. Take the Everglades, for example, the northern Everglades or the Everglades headwaters. That's the next stepping stone in the northward recovery of the Florida panther. It's also the landscape that we need to keep held together and restored to improve water quality throughout our state. It's also food production and keeping those working lands in existence. When you have things like a pandemic that really hurt tourism, and or if construction slows down, that working economy, the food and fiber that's produced is kind of a backbone of Florida's economic activity that also benefits from this. It's really, the Florida Wildlife Corridor touches the lives of all Floridians, whether we have a direct line of sight or not. here in Tampa, the Green Swamp. That is the water tower that supplies nearly all of our water needs. That's a huge hub for the Florida Wildlife Corridor. And to be able to expand the protection around the Green Swamp through conservation easements, yes, it's going to help black bears move and expand from Chazawitska or maybe be a future home for panthers. But it's also going to make sure that when we turn our water on, that it's fresh and clean and abundant.
Having accomplished your Path to the Panther project and you're seeing Florida Wildlife Corridors Act signed into law, what's next for you?
I'm going to be continuing to use my voice in every way I can for this issue until I can take my kids on that same journey and that green land is still there. Or, you know, I don't think it's beyond our lifetime that panthers could be back in the Okefenokee. And so I'm going to keep working on that story. I do think this is a model that could apply to the rest of the country. And so helping to share that story as well. We have a pretty bold conservation plan that National Geographic and the Nature Conservancy and now the Biden administration and leaders from both parties are invested in. And that's this idea of 30 by 30, that we need to protect 30% of the planet by 2030 to help stem off the biodiversity and climate crisis. Well, what better way is there to get to 30 by 30 than a green infrastructure plan of wildlife corridors? The United States has about 15% protected land on tolls now. That's a lot more protection that needs to happen in a relatively short time. And the model of the Florida Wildlife Corridor could be really helpful in showing other states and other ways that we can achieve this connected network for our country.
Sure. And especially when you look at that 30 by 30 vision and what is already conserved, so much of that is out west in those huge landscapes, obviously, just Alaska alone. But when you're talking about East Coast and in highly developed areas, because this Florida Wildlife Corridor, Miami's right there, Tampa's right. I mean, it pretty much goes right around Orlando, Jacksonville. This demonstrates that. And again, I'm not going to use wild areas because these are not wild areas. They're undeveloped areas. But it shows that nature needn't be over there and cities and people over here. It shows that we can coexist closer and more harmoniously than I think a lot of people still even believe.
That is a very good point. And it's all right here and it can work together. You see it in other countries. You see leopards traveling on the urban fringes in densely populated areas in India. And this is an example of how we can do this, and we can do it in the East. We have the Appalachian Mountains as a natural backbone for a wildlife corridor up the East Coast of the United States. And when those panthers get to the Okefenokee Swamp, how do we get them to the foothills of the Appalachians and connect all the way back up through the continent? Wow. But for my work, I mean, I'm headed back to the field later this week, and I'm going to be photographing some properties on that Florida Forever list that are in the wildlife corridor, because we still have a chance to show people these amazing opportunities, these working lands and other properties that without continued investment likely will be lost. This legislation is a huge accomplishment. It's a huge step forward, but the real work now is sustaining the public investment that it's going to take to achieve the actual intended outcome, which is a connected corridor throughout the entire state.
You mentioned about your kids. How you put in an awful lot of time out in the field. How have you managed to balance having a family life with that?
My wife, Susie, who's also working full time as a superhero.
That always helps.
It is a big sacrifice. I mean, it is hard to be away as much as I've been away. At the same time, I'm really thankful that I'm working in Florida. So even if I go to the field for 10 days, I can be home, or I can work for a few days at a time and come back. So I'm not missing big chunks of life with the family. And I love it when I have the chance to take them with me. When I go out to service a camera trap and I can send my daughter Eldridge or daughter Nell as a test panther to crawl through and trigger the cameras for me.
They must love that too. Okay, be a panther for daddy now. How old are your kids?
My kids are 3, 5, and 7.
The right age to be a panther.
That's right, yeah.
Carlton Ward Jr. has been our guest. Check him out online, carltonward.com, floridawild.com, one of my favorite social media follows on Twitter and Instagram, @CarltonWard. Thank you for joining us today. thank you more so for all of the work you have put in over the last decade plus to help make this Florida Wildlife Corridor a reality, and the continuing work you will do to make sure that it's seen through. Thank you.
Thanks, Carl. This was great.
Thank you both. Let's get out into the corridor together. I really appreciate you helping share the story. And I know Craig has been out, been in these swamps with us, but we'd like to get you both out there in the future.
Absolutely.
If you want any more recommendations for, you know, you talk to Jane Lawless from Buck Island Ranch. He's great, but there's some treasures of Floridians that I've had the privilege to meet as we've traversed these corridors. Love to connect you up with some of them.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah.
Conservation, Craig, and you know this, it's countless city council meetings and county commission meetings and Florida Wildlife Commission meetings. What I love about the Florida Wildlife Corridor, it is the big swing for the fences that is just this grandiose vision. And what's even better, it touches almost every person in the state, every area of the state, and it's got a chance, man. It's got a chance.
Well, and the other thing too is one of the things you learn in watching environmental issues in Florida is victories tend to be temporary. You know, Some developer wants to come in and put a Walmart on a land that's covered in mangroves, and the citizens come out and swarm the zoning board and say, don't do this. And the zoning board votes it down. And everybody pats themselves on the back and says, great. And then 5 years later, some other developer comes forward and they have to do it all over again.
Yeah.
But the way they're approaching this with the with conservation easements and with willing sellers who want to continue working their land, but also making sure it's preserved, those victories are permanent. And that's the nice thing about it.
Right. And so much of the conservation movement is playing defense, constantly playing defense, and then marginal victories. Well, we saved half of it, or it wasn't as bad as we hoped, or instead of 5,000 homes, it's only going to be 3,500. This is going on the offense and saying, nope, this ribbon down the spine of Florida is going to be protected forevermore. And, you know, I distinctly remember that first image Carlton was talking about from the podcast of what this would actually look like and how it is actually possible. And again, the vision is a panther or a bear or anything, you know, could walk from Florida Bay to the Okefenokee Swamp and not have to cross pavement, not have to go through a parking lot, a subdivision, past a Quick Mart or a Publix. And just the idea that that's even possible in Florida in 2021 with 20 million residents and 1,000 new ones every day is an astonishing opportunity that boy, I hope becomes a reality.
Sure. Well, and you know, it's interesting because we get locked into this idea that animal populations are in a certain place and they stay there. And I learned that was not true early on when I was started covering environmental issues in Florida. I heard about this one panther, Florida Panther 62, that was the first one with a radio collar on to cross the Caloosahatchee River. And he crossed the river, swam across the river, and just kept going. And he wandered all over Central Florida. At one point, he was on the outskirts of Disney's Animal Kingdom, if you can believe that. And basically, and I talked to some panther experts, and they said, basically, this proves that all of Florida has panther habitat in it. And what we have to do is find a way to connect it.
Well, and maybe this is something we should back up a little bit here. When you're talking about a bear or a panther, we're not talking about a gopher tortoise or a raccoon. When you're talking about a large mammal, and you highlighted this in Cat Tail, your wonderful book on the Florida panther, brilliantly, you're talking about hundreds of square miles each individual.
They're wide-ranging animals. Yeah. And they need a lot of room to roam, and they need, you know, things to eat. So they need a place that has deer, for instance, for the panthers, and for bears, they eat a lot of berries and things like that. So,
yeah. Well, it's a great vision. FloridaWild.com, FloridaWildlifeCorridor.org. Follow along online. You can help be a part of this movement at the grassroots level, volunteering, following on social media, voting, talking to your local elected officials about this. And boy, what a great opportunity this is for the state.
And if you get a chance to see the any of the documentaries that they shot about the Wildlife Corridor expeditions, they're really wonderful. Beautiful imagery and a really good message about how special this state is.
You can go to Carlton's website and check that out.